And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker and moderator, Jessica Buchleitner. Jessica Buchleitner. Yeah, let's get that applause in. She's a rock star for sure. Jessica Buchleitner is a multimedia journalist, a producer, a storyteller, and a communicator. She's the author of the 50 Women Anthology series, which is a two-book collection of stories exploring the human condition in the context of major world events and global issues as told by 50 women from 30 countries. Jessica was named Journalist of the Month in May 2015 by International Journalist Network and Interim Executive Editor of Women News Network in July 2015. Every March from 2012 to 2015, she has been a delegate, a non-governmental organization delegate to the United Nations for its respective annual sessions of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. She currently serves on the board of directors for the San Francisco-based NGO Women's Intercultural Network, WIN. And tonight's program is brought to you in association with WIN, who is also a consultative NGO to the United Nations Economic and Social Council. Please join me in welcoming Jessica Buchleitner to our podium.
Wow, thank you, Linda. You know, I have to say, when I found out that this program was a sold-out program after everything that happened from the recent election, my heart skipped a beat, and I thought, this is amazing. Why? Because people want to dialogue right now. And that's what we're here to do tonight. So thank you all for coming out this evening and talking with the women of 50 Women tonight. I know that the recent election, the U.S. election, has turned the tables in many ways. And tonight, our program is called Global Women Speak, Advice to Our Next President on Issues Affecting Women. This is not just in the United States, but this is globally as well, as you can see by the women represented here today. So I want to officially say and extend a welcome to President-elect Donald Trump into the new administration, but I also want to invite the new administration to talk to us, to talk to women, to dialogue with us about the most important issues facing us in the U.S. And I'm going to present a very important policy tool that can help us with that in the grassroots. But I want to invite the administration to dialogue formally tonight. These women are going to talk about their personal stories because, let's face it, statistics and data are one thing, and they're very important. And the U.N. revolves around statistics and data, but we need personal stories to touch us, to uplift us, and to move us into action. And I think when you hear these women's stories tonight and the recommendations that they're making to the administration, you will realize why this tool I'm about to present is so important. So let me begin, and I will be very brief. CEDAW is a multifaceted, very, very complicated thing. Now, how many of you in the room are familiar with CEDAW, or the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women? Is anybody? A couple of us, but a lot of you are not. And that's what I wanted. I had so many people coming to me after the election saying, you know, I have a lot of mixed feelings, or I'm afraid, or I'm unhappy, or I'm this. What are women going to do? You know, there's the Roe versus Wade issue. There's the Supreme Court seat. There's so many things potentially at stake for women in the United States. What is something that we can do? And there is something that has already been going on that we already have been doing around the country now, that is an instrument the United Nations has given to us globally as women that can help us. So let me go through this very quickly, and then you will hear a real-life living example in Uganda of how the CEDAW Ordinance, as it's formally called, has helped women in Uganda with access to land rights, which is something they have struggled with since the dawn of time. So CEDAW and the new administration, everyone. The facts. CEDAW is nothing new. It was adopted in 1979 by the United Nations General Assembly. Currently, 187 member states have ratified it, but the United States remains the only industrialized nation in the U.S. that has yet to ratify the CEDAW ordinance. Why? Because once it ratifies it, once it becomes signatory, it is bound to the terms and conditions of it and all of the provisions. And these provisions are very important. They contain issues on sex trafficking and domestic violence, ensuring right to vote, ensuring inheritance and land ownership. And these are very important things. And still in the U.S., where, for example, reproductive rights continuously come up in election after election. So we need something that will make us as women feel safe. Presidents Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, however your mixed feelings are on those administrations, did achieve ratification of similar agreements, the Convention on Against Torture, Genocide, and all forms of racial discrimination as well, which were also UN conventions and have been adopted by the U.S. But CEDAW, however, has not. It is currently in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In July of 2002, it was recommended, but the treaty has never come before the full Senate for vote. We have had Barbara Boxer host forums. We have had many, many famous women politicians speak out on behalf of CEDAW. We've had meetings in the Bay Area, countless meetings about it. Christine Bronstein, in particular, who was founder of A Band of Women, has hosted a number of forums and has participated in a lot of action on CEDAW. And still, we remain here. The treaty requires the support of two-thirds of the U.S. Senate. So given our current political landscape and looking and facing this new administration, I want to put this on their plate. And I want to say to the new administration coming in, we're tired of waiting. We want to see this ratification. We want to see you support us as women like 187 other member states of the UN have done. And wait until you see what CEDAW has done in some of these countries around the world. What can CEDAW do for women? It can reduce sex trafficking and domestic violence. It provides access to education and vocational training, ensures the right to vote. It ends forced marriage, child marriages. It helps mothers and families, which the Millennium Development Goals 3 and 5 specifically addressed at the United Nations, maternal health and the health of women and children. The new Sustainable Development Goals released last year have, I believe, 3 to 4 provisions within them on maternal health. Maternal health continues to be a struggle around the world, and you'll hear about that in a second. They also ensure our right to work and to own a business. Can you imagine not being able to own a business because of your gender? Well, this still happens around the world. But that has changed. One specific example I can give you that is reflected in the 50 Women books is in the Russian Federation, CEDAW has been used to eliminate bride kidnappings. So this was the practice of going out, snatching a woman up off the street, and making her your wife. And she just has to be happy with that and can't question it. Well, not so much anymore. In the country of Georgia, local administrations and police have made laws against this and have been diligent about enforcing these laws over the last 2 decades. And you, if you read the 50 Women book, you can read about that in one woman's story. What did CEDAW do globally? Here's just a couple of examples. One specific example I love to give is in Mexico, right? There's a lot of issues on domestic violence in Mexico, has been for a long time. But it got to a point where all 32 Mexican states adopted the measure, all 32. But the U.S. has not managed to ratify it. We still remain one of few member states that has not. Kenya has used it to address inheritance rights. Bangladesh, and Nwe will be speaking about being from the Bangladesh-Burma border, has used it to attain gender parity and increase school enrollment of women. So it's a very important tool, as you can see. When Women's Intercultural Network has launched the Cities for CEDAW campaign a few years ago, and the goal is, if the federal government isn't going to get it done, we can get it done. At the state level, at the national level, at the global level, we can get it done, and we are getting it done. Our goal is to get 100 municipal CEDAW ordinances out by 2018. And this is just some of the information, and we're happy to hand this out later and share with you later. But just to let you know, San Francisco was the first city in the U.S. to ratify the CEDAW ordinance, which I find to be amazing, and it makes me very proud to live here, right? So we have tools in place in San Francisco that help us. We have recently had success. The Iranian Circle of Women's Intercultural Network just got it passed with the help of City Councilwoman Susie Price in Long Beach. So they have now adopted it, and they will be putting this policy to work in the city of Long Beach. These are just an example of 32 cities are exploring ordinances, 19 have passed. So we are moving fast if the federal government and if the new administration should choose not to move quickly. That's okay, because we're going to do this at the city level. So I want you guys very quickly to have an example of how CEDA has worked in Uganda, specifically dealing with land ownership rights. WIN's global partner, Women's Intercultural Network's global partner, Siobhan Nealon, is here, and she's going to briefly tell you how this important tool has worked in Uganda for women.
Thank you, Jessica. Hi, everyone. I'm Siobhan. I'm the founder of the One Mama organization and the Fighting for Joy community movement. So how I'm partnered with is with the WIN organization. So One Mama is, I'm the United Nations global partner. I work on behalf of land rights as a global partner for WIN and as a United Nations delegate, so bringing a voice to my community in Uganda. So what One Mama does is we help impoverished women have babies safely, HIV prevention from mother to baby, birthing kits, medical supplies, malaria testing treatment, HIV testing, and then vocational education. So how we fund ourselves, like half of what I'm wearing, basically my outfit saves about 200 lives. And this is made by the community. We teach the community how to make it, and this is how we fund ourselves. So if we go back to the last slide, I'm terrible at this stuff. Anyway, basically it says those are the things that we need to, how it changes. So part of why WIN and One Mama worked together was to start seeing how we can actually make these changes on the ground. So from a vocational standpoint, we're noticing we started a domestic violence program in our community last year, and I realized 69 to 79% of the community is under some form of violence, that are females 14 to 49. So we decided that it was actually impacting the clinic. It was actually impacting the community. We couldn't actually handle the birthing problems because we had these other problems. So everything is so interrelated that you have to deal with each one of these stages. And what I think is why she's having me talk about it is that we started doing this from the ground level, and we can see the impact within a year. Already we're seeing less instances of domestic violence in our village. And this is a community that women feel like if they're not loved if they're not hit, and men feel like if they don't hit, they're not a man. So we're dealing with those kinds of issues. So what we want to do is show that we can bring these kinds of issues and show the change even in these kind of places and show those kinds of changes here at the city level. And if we can do those kinds of changes in Uganda, we should be able to do them in the United States. So if you have any more questions about anything that I have to do with this, you can just reach out to us, and I'm here to support WIN and One Mama and the UN. Thank you for letting me be part of this.
Thank you, Siobhan. Now I want to introduce our first speaker. So our first person tonight is Masha Maslova. Masha comes to us from Moldova, and she is currently with the Silicon Valley Talent Partnership. In the past, she has worked with the Center for Citizens Initiatives on U.S.-Russia relations. Masha grew up during the collapse of the Soviet Union and had a very interesting experience coming to the United States. I think her perspective is something we all need to hear after going through the recent election.
Thank you, Jessica. I first wanted to echo what she, what she said about this being a sold-out event. I think, thank you, first of all, for being here. It's an honor for us, but I think it's a sign of times. It's a sign of where we are as a gender and as a country. And I think we need to have this space to have a conversation, to connect with each other, to encourage each other, to inspire each other, so we can, you know, become a force to be reckoned with. So my journey, I honestly don't even know where it began. I think probably the collapse of the Soviet Union was a big, big part of it. And the transition that we were undergoing at the time was pretty chaotic. It was pretty challenging. And I found myself in a republic, Moldavian Soviet Republic, which at the time was experiencing the rise of ethno-nationalism. And after the Soviet Union collapsed, we pretty much had civil war. And the place that where I lived separated as a result, and it declared its independence from Moldova, but was not recognized. And I know probably many of you have not heard of it, but it exists to this day as a de facto state of Transnistria, and that's where I'm from. I think maybe when I was in the sixth grade, I decided that I wanted to come to America. I think it may have been a sense of curiosity, great curiosity, but it was also perhaps watching my mom struggle, watching her being so dependent on my father, who was actually, he had a problem with substance abuse. I did not want to live a life like that. I wanted to make something out of myself. So I got this idea that I wanted to come to America when I was 12. It took about 9 years for me to make it to this country. And the story, I guess the brief version is such that I pretty much had to make a decision to leave within 15 minutes. I remember I was in Russia. I was actually studying at the time, going to college. And I got a call from Moscow telling me, you know, we have this opportunity. You had applied for the program and you picked these types of camps to come, but we don't really have that. So we have this camp in Cupertino for disabled physically and mentally disabled children and adults, and you please let us know if you want to come. And I said, well, can I think about it? And when do I leave? And they said, well, tomorrow you need to be in Moscow. And I lived about 5 hours away from Moscow. So tomorrow you need to be in Moscow for the orientation, and you need to fly out on Sunday, so the day after tomorrow. And I said, can I think about it? And they said, well, you have 15 minutes. And then if you don't take it, then we're just going to move it on to the next person. And so I remember hanging up the phone and I started calling everybody, my mom, my friends, but nobody was answering. So I think it had to be my decision. I think they would have probably talked me out of it. So there I was. I called them back and I said, yes, I'm coming. And so there I was, and the story unfolds in a very unexpected way that truly changed the trajectory of my life. So I came to New York, and I flew from Moscow to New York, and I ended up spending 2 days in New York instead of one because they did not have a ticket for me to my final destination, which was San Jose. And I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified because I did not have really enough money on me. I had $50 only, and it was a lot of money at the time. But one way or the other, I ended up at the airport, and I got my ticket, and I was on the flight to San Jose. And I think halfway through the flight, a lady moved over. I mean, she actually asked, is there anyone sitting next to you? And I said, no, please, please feel free to take the space, to take the seat. And we started a conversation. And her question was, well, where are you from? Where are you going? And so I briefly told her the story. It's been my dream to come to the United States. And so all I know, I'm going to this camp in the woods. And she said, well, do you have a sleeping bag? And I was like, I didn't think of that in the chaos of all of this. And so she, in that moment, she handed me the card, her business card. And she said, call me if you need one. And I think that was sort of the beginning of our story, you know, and me meeting the family. But I think it was a shocking incident in a way that I was not used to strangers really caring about others. And my first instinct was, well, why? What's in it for her? Started getting suspicious. But I think, in a way, I want to say that this was my first encounter with America. And in a way, that was an encounter with American generosity, with American kindness, with empathy, care for someone you don't know. And I think it truly had a profound impact on me. In a way, it determined the trajectory of my life, as I had said earlier, because what I wanted to do down the line, and the story goes on. I can briefly mention what happened, but I think it really redefined what I wanted to do with my life, and I think. She and her husband, who's here, by the way, today, Bob Denevim, he became a, sort of like a father figure to me. What they did for me that summer made me want to give back and made me want to dedicate my life to service. And I think we should never underestimate the ripple effect of lending someone a helping hand. And I think profoundly, this is what this country is about. So,
Masha, one of the most important things you ever said to me that I never forgot, I can quote a lot of these women's stories after the extensive amount of editing that had to be done. But one thing she has always said to me was, my impression of the American dream and of America were from these two kind people that took me into their home as though I was their own daughter and helped me. And she said, I was coming from this other mentality of this person's helping me, what's in it for them? But, you know, I'm coming into a mentality of these people are just giving. And it completely changed your life, you said.
It did. It really did. What I ended up doing afterwards was, you know, pursuing. I came back. So I spent 2 months in the United States, and I went back to Russia to finish my degree, and then I returned and I started working. Well, actually, I went to San Francisco State and I got my master's in international relations. But then I ended up working for a nonprofit to improve the relations between the two countries. And on the sidelines, I've always been kind of thinking about, you know, helping, empowering someone to live their best lives, to give an opportunity, because I absolutely could relate to it. Had it not been for them, I would have truly not been here today. What I do now is, you know, in my work is also working for a nonprofit and work with communities that, you know, need an opportunity, need a hand, sort of what I got. And this is my way of giving back. And I truly believe this is what this country is about. It was so extraordinary in terms of what it did for me. And I think we need to, when, you know, there's so much negativity, there's so much name calling out there. But I think when we get back to basics, you know, or when we think about what, you know, if disaster strikes and how we come together as a country, I think we need to connect to that. This is where, you know, where we are and who we are. So I think that's kind of my perspective. I guess as far as the recommendations go, maybe it'll be round two.
Well, I think what's amazing about Basha's story is it connects us back to what it means to be American, to help people in need. It's all the founding of American values and who we are. And I think after what happened with the election and all the turmoil, the protesting, everything that was going on, people need to be reminded of that. And I think the most empowering message in your story is that. So thank you so much, Masha, for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. We have some questions coming in. Feel free to write them on the card. We will address them after the speakers. Our next speaker is Miss Silvia Vasquez Lovato, who's originally from Peru. Silvia wears many hats. She's like a tech goddess. As I'm doing my master's at Northwestern here, navigating computer science, I'm like constantly thinking of Silvia. Well, Silvia can do this. I can do this. So Silvia founded Courageous Girls after an experience with sexual violence and, you know, just kind of casually became the first Peruvian woman to summit Mount Everest a couple months ago.
Thank you.
You know, just in her spare time. So Sylvia is going to talk to you today about her experiences. And
yes. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here tonight. And first of all, Jessica, we need to give a big round of applause to you because of what you have done. Actually, I've met Jessica about 3 years ago, and this vision for her to put this amazing book together, it took a lot of her. And it's an amazing, I guess, honor being here. And thank you so much for what you've done. So I want to start with a little poem that I just recently read, and I think it's timely. So, oopsie. Okay. The day the mountains move has come, or so I say, though no one will believe me. The mountains were merely asleep for a while, but in ages past, they had moved, as if they were on fire. If you don't believe this, that's fine with me. All I ask is that you believe this and only this, that at this very moment, women are awakening from their deep slumber. If I could write entirely in the first person, I, who am a woman, if I could but write entirely in the first person, I. It's a beautiful poem by Akiko Yozano, which was written in 1917, and I think it just highlights the plight that women we have, and I found it to be very timely in, you know, the era and the recent turn of events. But let me share a little bit of my story. I was born and raised in Lima, Peru, and I was part of a very sad statistic globally. I was sexually abused as a little girl. And this really marked my life, and it brought all the trauma and stigma that is associated with it. When I told my parents just when I was 15, they asked me to leave Peru, and I came here to the U.S. with a scholarship to start university, almost running away from my problems, trying to start anew. And we all know what happens when we run away. You know, the problems temporarily go, and then they come back, and sometimes they come back strongly. So I was dealing with a lot of that stigma for myself. And around August 2005, as I was 31 years old, professionally I was developing my career, but internally I was really struggling with a lot of vices and a very self-destructive behavior. And my mother asked me to come down to Peru and do a powerful healing meditation with her. And that was a magical moment, which I'll connect towards the very end. I need to disclaim that I'm a Virgo, so I'm very literal. But then I'm also a tiger in the Chinese sign, so I'm very adventurous. So combine the two of them, you can have interpretations. But on this meditation that I'm doing with my mom, the vision of my little girl comes to mind, and for me to connect her with my adult self. And many of us, when we have trauma, we block things because of our self-protection, our own surviving. And so that's what I did. But in this vision, the two of us got connected, and then we needed to be walking among mountains. And so the Virgo side of me took that literal, and I figured, well, if I need to walk among mountains to connect to this painful side, then why don't I go to the tallest mountain in the world? And so I decided in October 2005 to walk towards the base of Mount Everest. And I'm going to read quickly the excerpt of the book that just talks a couple of paragraphs about it. So in October 2005, I flew alone to Kathmandu, Nepal, and I started my journey with a guide and a porter. I had never tackled a mountaineering trek in my life before. In fact, the closest I've ever gotten to a trekking adventure occurred when I was 5 years old, and my family tried putting me atop of a small rock. I had such a bad tantrum that I had to be taken off it. I also didn't own most of the trekking equipment. One of my closest friends lent me her backpack jacket and other items. But there I was, about to start following a unique journey, trusting my heart. On our first day, we reached a small town of Namche Bazaar at 11,300 feet, the entryway to the Himalayas. As we left in the early morning hours towards the mountains, a power hit me as I saw the first sight of them. Never in my life had I witnessed such a powerful sight of nature. Here I was, surrounded by these beautiful snow-capped enormous peaks. I felt the sheer beauty of these gigantic mountains towering majestically above me, making me feel so tiny, almost insignificant, yet so welcome and embraced. Walking among these mountains, I felt so alive, so held, so secure. Witnessing such a powerful space, I had to surrender to nature. I will experience safety as if the world and the universe embodied on these incredible mountains were acknowledging the innocence and purity I thought had been taken away from me. I remember envisioning my little inner damaged girl holding my hand and walking next to me and connecting to her from a place of strength. It was such a powerful healing moment that I felt this amazing surge of energy, courage, and confidence burn within me, something I had never experienced before. So this was the beginning of an amazing journey. I made it to base camp in a record time, and I promised Mount Everest that I one day was going to come back and attempt climbing to the top by becoming a mountaineering and coming back with a social cause. And that was the beginning of my special journey. I think this was in October 2005. As always, make this big promise. I started climbing a couple of the big summits around the world trying to get the experience. But then life got in the way. My mother got sick and she passed away in April 2013. A couple of months later, I got divorced. So I was dealing with a lot of pain. And it seemed that every time I kept moving away from, you know, this promise, nature would bring me back. I was able to refound my healing again in 2013 when I retook climbing and ultimately led me to create my own nonprofit called Courageous Girls to help young survivors of sexual abuse and any kind of sexual violence and bring them to Base Camp Everest, a group of women from Nepal and San Francisco. But the journey itself was a little bit of self-discovery for myself to regain that strength, but also to inspire other women. And even as I launched my foundation, I experienced the traditional up and downs. The first group of women I was going to try to bring, ended up losing them a couple of months before we were going to leave. The self-doubt about, you know, what I was creating was really tough. And, you know, if anything, you know, just when I thought I had something secure, I will splatter down again. And so for me, it ultimately, last November, I was very lucky. I was able to bring my first group of Nepali survivors of sexual trafficking to Base Camp of Everest. And I was able to see how nature had the same influence it had on me. This year, I brought the Nepali girls back as mentors to a group of American girls. And once again, I was able to see how nature was able to do that. And it ultimately led me on my own journey of attempting to climb Mount Everest. And that itself was a whole different can of worms as how challenging it was. I remember looking at the mountain when the group left me. And as I looked at the mountain, the first thing that came to my head was like, what in the hell am I doing here? Am I crazy? It had been so easy to talk. It had been so easy to envision that I wanted to do this. But now, as I was looking at my final mission, everything kind of started shaking inside of me, and I hadn't even placed a feet on the mountain. So the amazing journey for me was even, you know, never giving up, you know, and trusting the setbacks, trusting what could happen. I was lucky that during my Everest climbing expedition, one of a very famous male guy came and stayed with us and told me that we were going to have bad days. We were going to have days in which we were going to be ready to quit, and we needed to take them. And it was a very literal piece. And he said, don't judge yourself about it. It's not about you. It's about just experience itself. And even as we were having our final rotation into the summit of Everest, when we were going from Camp 2 to Camp 3, we got caught up on a storm that almost killed all of us. And the first thing that I did, I got into my tent. As I barely got into my tent, I remember collapsing and crying because of I felt my mortality for the first time. I felt that, what the hell am I doing here? You know, who am I to be here? I needed to be held so badly, and there was no one, which also made me relate that how sometimes we're going to put ourselves into journeys and we're going to be very much alone. And what I did, I grabbed my oxygen tank as if it was my teddy bear, and I clutched it on it, and I kind of hugged myself. And as I was crying, if anything, the coldness of the tank at least made me feel I had somebody there. But it was also very poignant piece for me to do this part. And the following day, we managed to leave. We had a conditional goal for our summit. And it was interesting because, and the reason I'm bringing this, even as we were going up into the summit, we were constantly on the fear of turning around because the weather conditions were really bad. This is extreme altitude. We're in something that is called the death zone. We were over 27,000 feet, even with oxygen. And right as we were about to turn around, I remember, you know, trying to distract myself, and there was this beautiful imagery that came, which is actually, I think to me, it was more impactful than the summit itself. It was a beautiful, the sun started shining against the summit of Mount Everest, and it created the most gorgeous pyramid on the sky. And I remember looking at it and just, and I didn't take this photo, one of the guys took this photo, but it was so powerful that it just made me admire the journey that I was in. It just made me realize I am witnessing something very few people are ever going to do. And it just made me appreciate all the hard work that I had done, everything that I had created. And at that point, because I didn't know if somebody was going to take a photo, I told myself, doesn't matter if we turn around. I know I'll come back as many times, and I'll come back with a super camera to capture this beauty so that I can share it with everyone. But still, you know, we managed to make it to the summit, and it's itself, the journey was very powerful. But in self-reflection, what has really been something that I've gotten on these 11 years is that is, you know, we all have something that we can contribute. We all can easily make the change. It's always going to be hard to try to think. And I think with the recent change of events, we have that opportunity. And sometimes it's going to take looking at first to ourselves. I mean, just taking that chance. It can start very small. It can start with volunteering, because I did that a lot. It can start with just a little bit of giving back. And if we have something as well that we want to, you know, something personal, let's not be afraid of tackling. I mean, for me, I never thought I would become this outspoken person about child sexual abuse. It was my biggest shadow I've ever had. And now I'm talking about it. And I have found so much power about doing it. But what I would recommend is, you know, for me, my healing became through nature. For all of us here, you know, we should just connect to what makes us happy. And I think, you know, we have this opportunity right now. Instead of being, you know, kind of passengers, we can really make a change. And it can start very small, and you'll be so afraid the impact that it can have and the ripple effect. So, I mean, I think that's a little bit of my, you know, kind of couple of things. I mean, just keeping that vulnerability open as well. That is such a powerful word. Outside courage, what I have learned is vulnerability is actually almost love, and it can take us to places. I mean, it's always going to be a lesson. Might be a little hard lesson, a little bit of heartbreak, but we're always going to get a lesson. So,
Sylvia, thank you. Thank you. As always, that was amazing. She just came back from Peru, where she was a speaker at the TEDx. We're happy she's just right off the plane to join us.
Literally.
Now, our next speaker is a very well-known woman in the Bay Area. She, when this woman retired from Building Opportunities for Self-Sufficiency in Berkeley, SF Gate and the Chronicle did a whole feature on Buna. Buna Chima is, she's kind of like my auntie now, especially since I know her whole life story. And she has done work in the homeless community with homeless women and their children. She has saved countless individuals from the streets, from drug addiction, from so many things, and serious issues, sexual abuse, drug addiction, I mean, things plaguing women in this country. I did a feature article with Women News Network a couple of years ago where we'd interviewed several homeless women in the Bay Area, and it was very heartbreaking, many of their stories. So to have someone who goes out and is a warrior like this, Buna had a very long career with Building Opportunities for Self-Sufficiency. She's now retired. But continues to be a warrior woman. So she's going to talk to the new administration about what she needs from them. And judging by all your question cards, yes, we are still talking to the new administration here. Buna is going to make her recommendations on this specific issue.
So my first recommendation is that I be appointed as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And Mr. Trump, I'm waiting for the invitation, so let's move this ball around and get things done. I want to share two stories with you before. You can check out my life on Google. You know, I love Google because I get to check out all of yours. But I'm going to share two stories with you, one from 1971 and one from the last 2 months of what I've been doing. In 1971, when I first got to this country, I was 8 months pregnant and was an immigrant from India, but had spent a year and a half in South Vietnam working with napalm-burned children and ran a home for 10 kids. So I get here, and I'm walking up, I think Bancroft Way, and I had my, I was like, I'm pregnant, when the baby comes, I'm going to go somewhere, and the baby's going to come, right? That's how we do it all over the world. But not here. That's not quite how we do it here. So I'm beginning to freak out a little bit, and I see this sign that says, if you need help, come in today. If you need a miracle, it takes us a week. And I was like, you know, let's get on this wagon and see, you know, if we can do this without having to sit in a field. So I walked in and met an incredible person who was behind the desk and said, you know, don't worry. There's such a thing as Medi-Cal. There's such a thing as welfare. There's such a thing as this. We're going to help you through. And to me, that was a miracle. And I decided that even though I had a master's in journalism from Punjab University in India, that I was going to give back. Because to me, a lot is about giving back. And I think from what we've gone through in the last year or two of this election, it's time for President-elect Donald Trump to give back. And the only way that's going to happen is for us to remember that we did win the majority vote. Mm-hmm. That means we can organize and organize and organize and make that administration comfortable and say, you know, very nice things when they do some great stuff and create incredible policies. But when they don't, we're going to hit the streets. And we're going to hit the streets, whether it's a year, two, three, four. I won't even go into the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, because that journey gets too long. So I instantly felt that giving back would be to work with homeless women who were in critical situations, and started to work as a volunteer at BOSS, which is the organization that I was with. And one of the first calls that I got sent on was this young woman in People's Park, which you've all heard of, I'm sure, living in the Bay Area, in the midst of childbirth, at the same time eating raw liver. Because it was in her mind that the reason that the baby was coming out so fast was because she didn't have enough vitamin K. And people were standing around her. They had called the ambulance, and she was trying to convince the ambulance that, no, this was not the time, and this was not the time for her to give birth, and that they needed to go away. And that was my first call, and that was my first intervention. She managed to have the child, but of course the child was taken away from her because of the behaviors that she had exhibited during the time that, then, you know, the social workers show up and everyone shows up and all these, you know, you're declared deficient or all kinds of labels are put on you. And the interventions that we need do not happen. We are not skilled enough, trained enough to reach out to people who express their needs in a way that we do not understand. So irregardless of how much schooling we've had, as long as we carry our biases, our prejudices, all our isms, and fear that somebody's different and acting crazy, we can't really make good, decent policy in this country. And I believe that's one of the reasons that we do not have healthcare for everyone without having to pay for it, is that we just don't believe the pain of other people in the way that it needs to be believed and felt and honored and blessed and reached out to. We go 8 presidents later, and for the last 2 months, we have, about 2 months ago, a number of us in a particular group called First They Came for the Homeless have been setting up a camp in the city of Berkeley for men and women. And we have been raided 9 times. This is in the city of Berkeley. So you can imagine what's happening to homeless people all across this country. At 4 a.m., they don't come at like, you know, 6 in the evening. No, 4 a.m., the same 28 officers with trucks, wagons, whatever, they take everything. And they have done that. I think the 9th eviction's about to happen. 8 evictions where people have lost everything and gone from a community of about 38 to 40 people down to about 8. And of the 8 that are still in that camp, 4 are women. And their stories would break your heart. Yet they come back every time the camp is set up again. And they will keep coming back. One of them has been arrested. One has been beaten. And this continues in a city where we would not expect that anything like this would happen. So the work is hard, the work is difficult, and the work will continue. One of the biggest failures of the past 8 administrations, and I hold all of them equally accountable, has been the inability to come up with a way to house people in this country. The United States is one of the few nations that has still not ratified the right to habitat in the UN Human Rights. Oh, I'm sure you know what that's called.
The current campaign is called Habitat 3.
Yeah. So looking forward, of course, it'd be great, you know, if he does make that call and I show up and I get the job, because I know exactly what I would do, is invest, 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 and invest. We need to invest in human beings. We need to invest in each other. And while, you know, I love change. I think change brings opportunities. But I think this particular change is going to need a lot of help. And I think it's going to need help from those of us who are most angered by what has happened. It's some of the solutions, you know, we love making plans. We love doing plans. So the federal government will tell us, okay, you know, as each city, do a 10-year plan of how we're going to end homelessness, and then send it in with all your recommendations, and then, you know, we'll do something, and then I can tell you that homelessness is not going to end in this country, not in my lifetime, maybe in my kids and grandkids' lifetimes, but I know it's not going to happen in my lifetime, because the focus is not on humanity. You know, the focus is not on the people that are at the very, very, what we say, bottom. That focus has not been there for a long time. We have not invested in our rehab programs in the way that we need to. So we see the heroin epidemic all over the country. We don't have input into how best to do treatment. We don't have enough facilities where a person who is, you know, in the midst of a mental health episode that can trust that they can go to the hospital and be kept there and treated with dignity until they're well enough to come out into the community. Now, as you go in, 72 hours, you're out, here's your medications, and you're back in the bush and you've already sold your medications to buy food. I mean, we have so many layers and layers that we're going to have to peel through to have an America that is great again. Thank you.
Una, thank you. That was very compelling and true. And you give wonderful advice to the incoming administration. Thank you so much. Our last speaker of the night, last but not least for sure, this woman here is a fighter, a diligent fighter. Noe was born on the Bangladesh-Burma border. She refers to that as her country because several generations back in her family, they were expelled from Burma. And Noe's first taste of citizenship in an actual country was when she came to the United States with her children and her then ex-husband. Noe did a lot of work in Dhaka City in Bangladesh for indigenous women's rights. She moved to Thailand, where she was also undocumented, and continued to do work for indigenous women's rights. And now she moved to the U.S., where she is a face and forefront of the many indigenous refugee communities. She has been back and forth from Washington, D.C. to the United Nations, continuously speaking about the needs in her communities. She works on the ground level with all of the refugees from Burma and many other nations from Southeast Asia. And I also want to mention that Noe is a survivor of domestic violence, in addition to one of the founders of Rakhine Women's Union and Weaving Through Change, where she makes traditional Rakhine clothing to preserve her culture. So Noe is here today to make recommendations to the new administration about what we can do for indigenous women in the U.S., and this includes populations of women from Native American tribes all the way to the incoming refugee women that are gaining citizenship in the U.S. now.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much. This is my own weaving. This is my wonderful weaving in my own design. So thank you so much for being here. And after election, before election day, I was planning going to Washington, D.C. for January. But my plan was changed, and like most of like you, right? Because of that night, I realized that when I was younger, we were born, I was born in border to border. How many border I crossed, I really don't forget to count. So we crossed many border because of the reason, the country, government, dictatorship. It's all political reason. So we are crossing the border with hope. But most of the countries, people, government denying our rights. So that reminds me in new administration, especially Donald Trump administration, the agenda is anti-rights, women's rights, gay rights, indigenous people rights, people of color who come as a refugees documented or undocumented, denying everything. So their agenda is more about the hate. So, in United States, the people of color, women, all women, men and women today, we realize that we are here for hope, building new community, new society, but living in fear. Most of our clients, they call, they're seeking after election day for mental health support. My organization provides mental health resources for API minorities communities because of they're waiting when will be they will get deported, when will be family falling apart. This is very painful for all of us. And I had some conversation with people who are walking around the street. How do you feel after election? Nothing has changed because they're okay. They don't have to worry about anything. The human lives, that's what Jessica has asked me one day, what is important in today's world? All most important thing is human security. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about the country security. Each individual of us, we are living in fear. I've been fighting for women's rights, indigenous people's rights, what happened? Myself as a victim of, survivor of domestic violence. So we were going through all the emotional, the fear, living in fear, inequality, and justice. This is time for all of us standing together, sister to sister, community to community, partnering with organization to organization, and say no. Why? Because it's not okay. Because of this is the living with fear and fear, our children, our generation. Our children's learning from schools now, what is bullying about? And our the country's leader, bullying about women, bullying about the refugees, bullying about the undocumented people. So our generation, if we don't stop right away, what will happen? Most people will be bullying for each other. So we would like to see that the government, the leader, who respect their rights, culture, and dignity. Thank you so much. I will more than happy to answer your question because I'm the last speaker. I won't take that long.
Noe, thank you. Thank you so much. She's so humble for the amount of stages and podiums she has inhabited. So I want to remind anyone listening into the audio of this program that this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Global Women Speak, advice for our new president on issues facing women around the world and at home. I just added that to the title. I have in my hand some question cards. If any of you have questions for myself or any of our speakers, feel free to pass them to the lovely Linda right here in the front row. But I do want to start with some question cards, and I'll hand some of these off to you guys as well, if you could briefly give some answers. I really love this one. It's very funny. And I'm sure Donald Trump will love this one, too. You are trapped in an elevator with the Donald. You can ask him anything or tell him anything. What do you say? And then there's a star in the form of a disclaimer, and it says, make sure he doesn't grab your ... you know. I'm assuming that could be butt, breasts, whatever they're referring to. So I'm trapped in an elevator with the Donald. Well, here's what I would say. President-elect Trump, what is your administration going to do to help us help the women of the United States and of the world? That's what I would say. Ladies, Masha, what would you say to the Donald?
I think I will say first, you know, your wife and I are from the same part of the world. I actually wanted to briefly, you know, say I think Trump, in a way, is a state of mind. I think it's a state of mind for the half of the country. And I can pretty much take it down to education. The fact that so many opportunities bypass the children, they grow up with a very limited worldview. And I think people or women who voted for him, they think it's okay. They think that, you know, when that video was leaked, they thought, oh, it's just boy talk. I think, so what I wanted to say is it's also our responsibility as a society to make a difference. I think it's important that we raise our daughters. We teach them self-respect. We teach them that they can be anything that they want. But it's also very important to teach our sons that they are to respect the women and treat them equally in the workplace and in general. I think this is where change is going to happen because he and the fact that we have this Republican Congress is truly a reflection of where the country is.
Thank you, Masha. Sylvia?
I think I'll ask him, like, what do you have against immigrants? I mean, I'm an immigrant, and, you know, this country is based on immigrants, and if we look at the success, I mean, economically, and even so many people that have built his casinos and, you know, infrastructure, they're all immigrants. So he's focusing on a tiny percentage of, you know, people. And in any society, 0.001% of people, you know, will be the rotten apple, but that's not all of us. So what's his take on that part? I think, you know, a diverse society, an immigrant society, was really expands, I believe, you know, the advancement of a particular country. I mean, in many other places is proven. And many of us, I mean, we had to leave our countries for so many reasons. As if anything, we feel so grateful. And in my case, I know I worked so hard, you know, to try to stay here. I was so afraid of, you know, getting back to Peru. So So that kind of mindset that he's been given immigrants such a bad name, it would be my question to him.
Sylvia was also a Fulbright scholar. Well. She never mentioned that among all of her accomplishments, but yes.
But still an immigrant.
Yes. Yeah. An immigrant Fulbright scholar, which is really just awesome.
Well, thank you.
Buna?
I just want his Twitter account. Wipe it out. Give it up.
I would say, like Donald Trump, let's work together because we know you are new president-elect and president will be president in the United States. So how we can bring the inclusive society, no matter what people of color, no matter what differences, where they come from. So let's respect our dignity, our rights, and women or men, no matter what. So let's move on and let's bringing the problem is today's world, 21st century is loss of many women, domestic violence, rape, murder every day. So this is a systemic challenge we have. How we can fix together?
Thank you, Nwe. And our next question from, I don't know who this was in the audience, but does anyone see an optimistic side to the Trump administration? And that's been a question. I did an event down in Southern California at a couple different places a few weeks ago, and it was right after the election, 3 days after the election, and all these people were just saying, I feel hopeless, I feel this. So does anyone see an optimistic side of the Trump administration? I do. I see an optimistic side to what has happened, and what I see is after the wave of shock hit everyone in the United States, and this includes women that did vote for Donald Trump, because we have to realize that a lot of women did, and we want to respect them too. And I do. The optimistic thing that I'm seeing is I feel like people are going to come together now. Mm-hmm. I had one of my mentors, who's been involved with the United Nations for quite a while, Marilyn Fowler, said to me, she said, when countries are cohesive and they have cohesive leadership, people aren't as organized. But when the leadership is not cohesive, or they feel that it's not, or they feel a threat, they will organize, and they will organize fast. And that was why I opened this presentation with the CEDAW ordinance. People have been asking me, what can we do for women? I said, this is your best bet on a policy level that you as an individual can affect in your community that is binding policy from the United Nations, the highest player in human rights in the world. So that's my optimism. I'm going to go back down the line again. You didn't know you signed up for this, did you?
No, it's a good question. I mean, first, I wanted to say that, you know, if you analyze the type that he is, you start understanding, okay, this man wants to be loved. And so we don't really know where it's going to go. We really don't at this point. So we'll have to wait and see. But I absolutely agree with her in terms of coming together, seeing so many signs of that, you know, women in particular coming together and having a conversation. And one thing I saw the other day online was actually someone posted from someone who had listened to a call or was on the call with Obama. And so he said, just wait till I'm out of the office because there are certain limitations. I cannot do, you know, much. But I know quite a bit about community organizing. Yeah. So that is my hope. I think we're going to see more of him, his wonderful wife, and they're going to lead the way. Mm-hmm. They will continue to lead the way.
Thank you, Masha. Sylvia?
Yeah, I was going to follow up to Jessica's point about community. Right now, I don't know if some of you are, I mean, not everybody's involved on Facebook, but on Facebook, there were a lot of communities that started Bitches for Hillary, sorry for the bad word, Pantsuit Nation. But I have found that they've been amazing. I mean, everybody got all pumped up. But after the election and after the results, there's been a much stronger connection, and people are doing different things. It's been a very strong platform. The day after the election, there's been a big there's going to be a big march that is going to happen in Washington that, you know, it's getting organized. I even think the day of the election here, there was talk to have a walk on Golden Gate Bridge. So my piece would be take advantage of the community resources that are getting opened up. I think there is, I mean, this powerful sisterhood and, you know, connection that is happening. And as we've heard, you know, that's what's really going to make the change. I mean, as long as our voices are heard, you know, it's really going to make the improvements.
Buna?
I just got off the plane from Madison, Wisconsin. And I go back and forth a lot. And when I got on the flight this time, I realized that I was the only person of color on the flight. And for the first time, I was really, really scared. Because I believe that there will be a time of dismantling that for president-elect to hold on to power, he has to first dismantle. So there will be a time of great disruption in this country. And then slowly, maybe, we will start to work together. But so for every disruption, we're going to have to be in the way and stand next to each other. Yeah. So my hope is us and see what comes out of what people like, not just President Obama, but I believe we're going to see Hillary back in the community, that we need to watch the appointments very, very carefully. You know, who is really going to be the inner crowd running this administration, because we know Mr. Trump is going to be, I won't even say it. I'm just going to first, you know, stand in the way of the dismantling and then be here for the rebuilding.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Buna. Noe?
Yes, our struggle is not just today, not just from the election. Our women, our people struggle many years, many generations. So we are continuing to advocate, continue fight against, and also protecting civil rights and human rights. That's important. Include the women's rights, include the immigrant refugees, everybody's rights. So that's my hope. And future, our future will be fighting against the racism and patriarchy and like misogyny, those kind of ideas, and who had that kind of mindset. So this is the time that we stand together. We will fight against those, you know, not tomorrow, after. It doesn't matter, President-elect Donald Trump, or no matter what. We are doing that. We continue to still will continue this kind of fights.
That's right, ladies. We the people are going to make America great again. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we have to say goodbye to Siobhan Nealon, who has to catch a flight. But I want WINS Global Partner for Uganda, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. It was kind of last minute, but she's been in and out. We have time for one more question this evening. So this is the last question. And I think that this is a... Is everything okay over there? Yeah. Is there dismantling going on? Yes. Oh, my goodness. For those of you in the audio, something just fell off of the table. The last question of the evening is, and I love this one. I think this is so powerful, because how many women out there are like this person who wrote this? As a woman who's never been specifically involved in or outspoken about women's rights / politics, how do I get started? How does one get involved, at least on the local level? And I'm so glad you asked that, because you have a lot of women here who jumped in and got into the fire. Sometimes we get a little burned, right? But we come back out and we shrug it off and we keep going. So my recommendation would be, if you want to get involved in something that will put pressure on this new administration, because they are elected officials, let's remember that Donald Trump, all of his appointees, everybody, I mean, these are elected officials. Their salaries are paid to serve us, the people. That's how our Constitution is set up in this country. And so it's up to us to keep going to the table and saying, here's what we need. Here's what we want. What are you going to do about it? And hold them accountable. As journalists, for any of my journalist colleagues in the room, it's up to us to investigate, to keep publishing articles on what's the progress, what are they doing, this is what we want to do, that's our role, as the, you know, the voice of democracy in many ways. So I would say, if you've never been involved, getting involved with CEDA or any local initiative, find something you're passionate about and get involved with that, because that's how you're going to make the most difference, is working. If policy language that's a document that's 20 pages is just, you know, kind of dry and boring for you, like it is a lot of people, you don't have to do that. There's ways you can get involved with an organization like BOSS, or Building Opportunities for Self-Sufficiency, or Courageous Girls.
or even the Silicon Valley Talent Partnership, or the Rakhine Women's Union and the Burmese community that Noé serves in your local community. So that would be my recommendation. Masha?
Well, I cannot emphasize enough the importance of education and both the state of education in this country and the lack of opportunities for so many, even in the Bay Area, and that's where I work. We have so many kids who, you know, they don't even want to think about higher education. This is not how their families set up. They just don't know. There's so much lack of awareness, so to speak. So I think you couldn't become involved with any of education initiatives, particularly for women, for young girls. So STEM education is one big area where, you know, we could become competitive, actually, in the big scheme of things. And I think someone said one time, I don't remember who, perhaps it's a famous quote, but it says, our finest hour, if we look back at our history, our finest hour came after our darkest hour. Mm-hmm. It's quite possible that we're in for a wild ride in some dark times, but I think something good is going to come out of it. Mm-hmm. We're going to come together. We're going to mobilize. We're going to become involved. And talk to your daughters and sons, mm-hmm. your granddaughters and grandchildren. It is very important.
For me, very quickly, for that person, happy to talk because I've been very lucky to have made a lot of networking and I know a lot of different people. So, you know, I mean, there are a lot of published resources. I'm thinking Emily's List. I mean, if you're not on Facebook, there is Emerge America. There is a lot of organizations that will be happy to actually trying to give you various, you know, options to do that. The fact that somebody's even asking, that's awesome because that itself shows that we have that drive. But it's going to be also a very soulful journey. I mean, mm-hmm. the right answer won't come in. And don't be surprised if you start following a group that you don't like it. That's okay. Then you'll find another group. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to connect you personally. If not, I can give Jessica a listing of places that I know. But I think that will be my recommendation.
Thank you, Sylvia. Buna?
I would say really take advantage of the technology that we've developed and mm-hmm. have. And if you are on Facebook, there are requests for us to sign petitions. And, you know, not everybody is cut out to go out and do the work. Sometimes it's okay to do it from home. Mm-hmm. Then technology really connects us to very powerful movements. Look what's happening in North Dakota and how much influence we've been able to have through Facebook that 1,000 people are there right now supporting indigenous rights. So I just wanted to add the technology piece.
Yeah. Thank you, Buna. Noé?
Oh, thank that person. Mm-hmm. I really feel like I would like to connect with you mm-hmm. personally. I would like to support you too. But this is a time, be brave, be bold, and there's no fear. Mm-hmm. Fear can change many things, so no fear. Yeah. So we can do two things, two, three things. One is involved with this group today is maybe 60, 70 people here. Connect with us and then make it that happen. And local, many government official or activists who are involved with local communities, connect with them. And also, if you would like to connect with us, especially United Nations, some kind of women's movement work, happy to join with us. And let's work on it, women's rights, indigenous people's movement, immigrant and refugee rights together. And I would love to invite you to join with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Noé. And unfortunately, that was our last question of the evening. But the last one was, what country or two or three do you think is best at advancing women's rights in the world? I think Norway is doing a damn good job. So congratulations, Norway. Thank you for holding the torch there. I don't know the number of their parliamentary representation, but I think it's something like almost like 50%, which is amazing.
And the many countries who are elected president, women, female president, thank them. They are the great country in the world.
Yes. Coming from the Aung San Suu Kui nation.
Yes. Bangladesh,
who's also a warrior. Well, I want to personally thank, first of all of you for attending tonight, because, like I said, when I found out that this was sold out, I was completely touched. I knew once President-elect Donald Trump was elected, I wasn't sure how this would go, and I thought, are people not going to want to talk, or are they going to want to talk? And now this has proven to me that, yes, people care, and they want to talk. So we've already proved the most important thing that we needed to prove, and that is that we can organize and stand together. Mm-hmm. And ask this administration of elected officials, I like to keep emphasizing, these are elected officials, to serve us in the ways that we need them and advocate for us where we need them. We've got to keep asking, because once you quit asking, and there was a comment on Facebook that was interesting to me. Someone said, you're wasting your breath or something. This administration doesn't want to talk to you. But how do I know that? Mm-hmm. And if I'm just going to sit here and say nothing and complain, that really doesn't put anything in motion. So what I'm going to do is join up on CEDAW and keep pushing forward on CEDAW and get to a point where we've got things like this, where ordinances protecting women are passed in around the United States when the federal government isn't moving fast enough. That's my highest and best use at times like these, and all of yours as well, on any of the things that they've given you advice on. So I want to thank, first of all, the Commonwealth Club. Thank you so much for having us. Linda Calhoun did an amazing job. I want to thank Sylvia Vasquez Lovato, Noe U, Masha Maslova, and Buna Chima for their comments here today. And we thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording of this. And now, it is my pleasure and honor to say that this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, and we're going to go beyond 113 years, people, is adjourned.